Okay. Understand.
He's still on. Are you with me, Glenn?
I am.
If you want to ask him a question, you can.
Sure.
Hey, once in a while we do an after the bell segment. Okay. I kind of wanted to follow up and with
oh,
some
we're
of these
both,
things.
We're both, yeah.
And so
go
I guess,
ahead, Todd.
Well,
if you had a question, go
I have a question up front because you're all – because everybody is – I don't want to say bullish, but everybody's friendly to the corn and the wheat market at the time. And usually that's a good time to say you want to be the other direction. Anybody fearful that that's the case? I mean that there's well,
like,
a possibility.
Like he said, the March time frame is when we have most of the highs. So if we continue up into March, then I'm going to be worried about it. To be ready to sell.
Let me adjust. Restate that. 45% of the yearly highs in corn have occurred in March and April. And by the way, no later than April 13th when that occurs. So, you know, I don't want to rush this thing. I want to address one thing you said there, though, Todd. Too. One thing you have to say about being bullish or when you want to sell and all that other stuff. We've got to define bullish for what term? Long term, short term, whatever.
Yeah.
And I'm about to be nervous about the short term. And getting a classic February break before we go higher later, the way I see it at the moment.
I just
now that's
we
on
hold
corn
for another week.
Is that on corn only, or is that also on wheat?
No, in fact, that's on both of them. The only thing I would say is Kansas City wheat has got tremendous chart patterns, and that we may be done with a correction just now. And you guys all know how when wheat decides to do something, it can be stupid. Hits vacuums, things like that, and. Well,
kind of like right now, right?
I read that in your newsletter. I liked your analogy. It's like stepping into an elevator, but you're not. There's no car, and you're not sure which direction you're going to go.
That's right. And the one thing I want to teach traders, I teach them. I say the logic of the markets is irrationality. The logic of the markets is illogical.
Yep.
And that's what it is.
So because you have so many influences.
When I listen to what I heard in the first half of the segment. And the statements being made here, and I'm not pointing fingers, so please don't take it that way. What I'm just thinking is I was listening. I tried to observe and listen to collective messages. And just about everybody was still thinking about selling. Even though we may be bullish, people are thinking about selling. It's when we're afraid to step up and say we ought to sell is when I get worried, number one. And number two, historically, when the advisory services and the public, I'm talking about the farmer public, sell a rallying market, that market's going higher. I'm not going to say it's going to be easily higher or regularly higher this year, but I would right now, I'm leaning towards way higher on the corn and the wheat side. Again, it could be a very violent, erratic matter getting there.
But
a lot higher between here and mid-year.
But, Glenn, why?
To just put the exclamation point on the why, you know, we talked to two elevators today that are closed the next couple, or not the next couple of days, but, you know, they were closed, are going to be closed Monday and Tuesday or today and Monday, you know, because they're plugged and it's not harvest, you know.
All right.
And I'm
Tell
not trying to
Tell me what the market doesn't know about the fundamentals.
Oh, I know. And I won't disagree with that whatsoever, but I think that what the market isn't factoring in is the fact that you get priced somewhat attractive. And I think you'll have a mass exodus by farmers.
Yeah, but here's the difference.
Do the fundamentals mean anything right now?
What's that?
Do fundamentals mean anything right now? They don't, do they?
Sure they do. The biggest fundamental out there right now, if it comes running in, is fund money. When you look at the total value of the corn crop, 11 billion bushel corn crop at $2 nationally, that's $22 billion. That fund money out there right now, and I heard a guy the other day speaking about this. He says he's represented the fund industry for 25 years. And when you ask me what is a fund or a hedge fund, he says, I shudder. I break out in cold sweats trying to explain what it is. There's no one universal thing, but it's estimated that the fund industry holds $1 trillion in equity.
Right.
Good.
So what I'm saying is instead of the
they
funds being an outside
themselves.
Factor right now, once they choose your market, it is a fundamental and the strongest fundamental of all.
Well,
and
yeah,
I've never been
dollars.
One championing the funds. I'll give you an example, though. In the April of 2004, I went over to Rock Falls, walked into a room of 70-some people, asked how many of them had ever heard me speak before or knew who I was. Three raised their hands. And I knew two out of three of them personally. And I went through that group when we were rallying into the spring, and it was actually the week we topped, and I asked them how many had this sold, how many that had that sold, et cetera. And I went off the psychology of it in part, but I said, I'm going to give you absolutely 100% objective fact. And I did. I rattled off statistics, the percent of tops, et cetera. And by my work, I had, as of that morning that I was there, it was a Monday night, a 3% chance that we were going higher, 97% chance we'd have the high. I told them that, and I asked how many of you guys are wanting to sell. Three more raised their hands.
Well, yeah, so that's par for the course for farmers, though.
The farmers are pretty bullish right now, Glenn.
Not over here.
Farmers are always bullish.
Not over here.
Here they are.
That's just because you guys had two big crops in a row, and you've been sitting plugged for about a year and a half.
You're in Iowa. Are you in Cedar Falls? I didn't write that down.
Yes, I am in Cedar Falls.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
But we have they're bearish over here. They really want to get to the message to me is, and like I say, a lot of advisory services out there are talking friendly for one reason or another, but they're acting negative by talking about selling it, and the farmers around me are talking about where to sell it, not where to buy it. I'm talking about the guys that need feed too, and I screamed at the guys last fall. I said, "You're not going to get cash prices much more than 10 to 20 cents better than this." If you are a feeder, lock up all the inventory you can. And, you know, I had I work with about 45 farmers in the area. One guy I know took heavy action on it. One.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They're not bullish by their actions. They're bearish by their actions. Now, don't get me wrong. This is probably the first time I've ever been on this show that I can think of that I said anything sounding bullish about grains.
Mm-hmm.
My worry is that the 5.5-year cycle in corn bottomed a year ago. That's what I worry has happened, because it's been even roughed up here lately. What I'm worrying about is that we get a fear of El Nino, La Nina. We look like we're heading for a drought year this year, all that good stuff, as we get into spring with the funds out there, that we're going to do more harm than good by raising prices way above value first. And then bury.
You mean all Iowa will be corn next year? Is that what you're trying to say?
Well, right now I got a guy that's been eyeing the asphalt out in front of the place here.
Yeah, I believe it. Yeah. I believe it.
And guys, also, that's one other thing. Long term. I don't know when, because I am very friendly to the ethanol industry. Mm-hmm. Long term.
Long yep. term.
But mm-hmm. listen to the rhetoric and the reactions of the investors going into it right now. I'm really afraid, like any new industry, and I'm not saying it's brand new, but I'm talking about an industry that's a growth industry.
Yeah.
You have this huge germination energy that chases into it.
They go under and get bought.
That's right. There's a whole string. Just get yourselves out a map and look at the James River in eastern South Dakota. Every 22 miles, there's an ethanol plant. What happens when we get just one drought year at the bad point in time for the startup of this industry? When those guys get crushed because the corn price is way high.
Yep.
And
their investors don't come through with their end of it. Yeah. Because the way the corn contracts are written on this, and I started to talk about this some time earlier, and the way that contract was written, when you got in it, you were on the line to deliver so much corn on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And then in the time where corn was short, and say corn went to $5 or $4 or $3.50 or whatever it was, they were capable of actually coming back and saying, "We want this much from you, and if you can't deliver the corn, then you're going to deliver cash, and you're going to deliver. You can deliver as much cash. I think it was up to the initial investment,
right?"
Now they give that back to you if the price goes back down. Yeah, but I was thinking, what's the possibility that corn's going to go higher? And I was like, I thought it was pretty good, actually.
1988, the sugar plant in Marshall, Minnesota, the corn syrup plant, they had producers in the summer of 88 drought that had to deliver $1.85 corn.
Yep.
Yeah.
The other thing, too, that I think is going to hit this stuff is if market history works, the energy prices, crude oil, should retrace 75% of what we went up.
Mm-hmm.
We should already have a major top that more or less holds. What happens if we happen to just do everything bad on timing for these new ethanol plants when we have corn get a drought and have crude oil get back into the 30s?
Yeah.
Yeah, ethanol would be.
Makes it tough, there's no doubt. And the only hope that we can have is that we have the industry started before that happens.
Hey, if I could buy an index on the ethanol industry for my kids, let them hold it for 40 years, I'd be happy. But compare what happened in the 1920s in automobiles.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And by 1929, there were over 600 automobile companies. If you bought Ford in 1932 or 33 stock, even as bad as it was today, you would have made out like a bandit.
Yeah, but you have to pick the right one is
the
problem.
But if you had bought Tucker, just change the T to an S.
Yeah.
But if you could have had an auto index then,
right,
you'd have been smiling.
Well, so then go buy Pacific Ethanol Company or ADM. Yeah, I think ADM works too.
You know, it's the best time to buy the stuff is when the news gets the worst, and that is even after you may have had a growth industry. When China came in to take over Hong Kong, If you go back and look at the history charts of the Hong Kong index and those markets over there, they had been flying high a decade before or even more recent than that. Then the market broke off terribly out of fear of China taking over Hong Kong. I bought that as a major investment almost to the day China took over and have just held on to it. And, you know, when other stocks were giving indexes were giving 0% return, negative returns, or even meager returns, you know, I'm setting those indexes ended up being, you know, up a couple 100% for me now. Mm-hmm.
I have to comment on one of your comments you made mm-hmm. that I think is really good is you start worrying when everybody gets one way or the other. Like when everybody's bullish, that's about the time to sell.
And that's mm-hmm. when I'm worrying about the ethanol. I find almost no naysayers out there about the ethanol industry. Yeah. And what I'm worried about now on a long, long term is that we're near the peak of the first wave up. And then we get that big, wicked second wave correction that rings out a lot of them, and that's mm-hmm. where you get the opportunities mm-hmm. to get a hold of some of them.
Yeah. I don't know. What do you think about Gates' investment out there in California? You looked at that stock at all?
No.
Okay.
No, I haven't right now. I tell you what, these times have been unusual enough, and I think I wrote in the very last newsletter about the need to adapt. These are as unusual as any of I have found, and I've studied active markets back to 1000 A.D., mm-hmm. and more active markets since about 1492, for example. Do you know why Columbus took off and why all that exploration was going on? Gold was at its historic high.
I was going to say that and spices, right?
They wanted to get gold from the new country. They
had a commodity. They were at the peak of a commodity bull market, bull phase. And so then they went off looking for.
So that's why we're looking into ethanol, right? Because energies are at their highs.
Yep.
So what did gold do after Columbus found it?
Well, in 1492, based on U.S. dollars, it was around 2,500.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
not worth that today.
From there, it was on down to 32, whatever it was when it was fixed.
That's right. That's right.
Profit margin is gone.
So yeah. I tell you, I the other thing I'm really worried about here on if I go to, let's say the next 15, 20 years in terms of the serpent type. Looking charts of, in other words, ups and downs that are going to go on. I'm really worried right now that maybe the real economic value of crude oil has been only $40. Maybe the real economic value of gold has only been, say, $400. Maybe the real economic value of copper has been maybe $125. What if all of that is true? What if we get the funds come in here now and drive corn up to, say, $350, $4 before planting? What happens if we bring beans up to $8, $9 before planting? Aren't we setting ourselves up for just a huge surplus down the road as we stimulate supply and further discourage...
Down the road? What do you mean? We got one right now, don't we? But I know what you're saying.
I'm talking about the macro degree behavior pattern rather than the...
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about the 10 billion excess corn supply, right? Not the 2 billion.
Well...
Or something of the sort.
I'm telling you this is historically, when you go through a speculative bubble... If you let a market work on supply and demand basis and try to ration supply and demand to each other, or supply and usage, to be more accurately stated, to each other, without a lot of speculation, I'm talking about being the overwhelming fundamental. When you do that, high prices discourage usage and encourage supply. Low prices, classic encourage usage and discourage supply. But what happens when you take a price artificially high if it's speculative money? And we're doing this right now over we started reaching our peaks in 2002 in the very first markets, cocoa, and since then we've been running up. What if this whole time is overvalued? I'm not saying it is, but I'm saying what if it is? If we have prices too high, then we're going to rotate use. If you can't get rid of the usage, you go to alternative sources like ethanol, et cetera.
Right, absolutely.
And the same thing can happen in anything out there that's going on. I start hearing 1980 all over again in different markets like fence row to fence row. we can't produce enough oil to satisfy everything. Sure we can. If the world economy collapses, we've got more than enough oil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Funny. Well, and that's the thing. I think you just said it. I mean, realistically, when's the last time, at least in the agriculture, production agriculture industry, when we saw things overinflated, prices, values on land, you know, the inputs, things like that, when they really aren't worth what we're paying for them.
That's right.
You know, when's the last time we saw that? Late 70s, early 80s, right?
And then,
except we had the interest rates.
I saw a lot earlier because I was farming in western South Dakota. But
Sure. Except, like Todd said, we did have interest rates at that point.
We had about a six-year period when the commodity world was reaching that level. That was 74 to 1980, and then we were done.
Right. Yep.
Yeah.
This rotation right now, when the stock market topped in 2000, I think this is what broke off this primary, you think about it like a nebulous in space or something, broke off this chunk of speculative money to rotate through real estate into commodities, et cetera.
Right, into raw goods or, essentially raw goods, things that are physical, not just paper.
That's
so,
right, and all of that historically, sad to say, is got the footprint of the end of a macro degree cycle. That's what scares me. The late 1920s had similarities. I'm not going to say we're the same. Similarities to this, just as an example.
We have a lot more controls in place that probably will keep us from that kind of decline. But
yeah, well, that or if the controls, it's like having the Hoover Dam built and holding all the water back. It's great until it breaks.
Yep.
The controls break. The other thing, every Fed governor of the modern times, the last 40, 50 years, when he's become the new governor or chairman of the Federal Reserve, he's had to deal with a major crisis within 2 years.
What do you look at the world economies? Do you think they're just ready to roll over? I don't think our economy's that great here. They keep talking about how great it is. I don't see it.
Seems like we're just walking on the cliff myself. The
guys that haven't seen it should read that one newsletter I wrote in December about the bison herd and the money moving around.
What's the date on that one? I may have that one.
I have that one.
Do we have that one? Okay, because I read the second one.
The first one is the oldest one was the most important read, I told Dave.
He didn't tell me that.
I figured that.
I'll get on him about that. I read the second one, but I'll make copies of the first one for these guys.
Well, yeah, I'll give you permission.
Okay. Well, thank you.
If the other guys that don't get the subscription want to contact me, I would be glad to email them. There's a couple of companions in their issues that probably would help them too. Yeah. But bottom line is
no, I meant for the two here in the studio,
right.
Not for all.
Yeah,
not for
unlike
our.
Unlike the 1970s when we had inflation and the masses, the vast majority of the masses had equity to or assets to inflate. This time, because there was a lot of we were a saving country at that time. So we unleashed a lot of energy into the economy because everybody benefited in one way or another, everybody meaning the vast majority, in one way or another from the inflation of the early 70s, whether it was their real estate going up or whatever. This time around, though, the general economy, we have, like most war economies, a segment has gotten the money, the investor group, the group that services the war machines, et cetera. But the average guy out on the street is a net negative saver right now.
Yeah. It's getting worse.
And how are houses being sold? The same thing we heard in 1980 in agriculture. Well, you get the loan as long as the cash flows.
Yeah, they don't give a rip. I mean, my wife works in a bank, and it's amazing. No money down, and you get to buy a house.
Well,
I remember having to pay 30% down to buy a house.
No money down, and all you got to pay is the interest in some cases,
And they give you $2,000 at closing to put in your pocket.
1980 in agriculture, and what happened by the mid-80s.
Yeah.
Boom.
Yeah.
So I'm really, I am not a doomsdayer, but I'm just worried that, one other thing. When back in 1999 and again in 2001-02, when we started bottoming out the commodity world, I was right and bullish as anybody that we're coming into a new commodity era. In fact, we're getting to go out with the direct mail. And I said, now, when did I make that quote? Because he's got it in there. He looked it up, and he said that I had made the quote in May of 2001, the one he's using, that we're going into an era that almost nobody's going to believe. Well, when we came off of 9/11, nobody was, the general public, percentage-wise, was not going to believe that we were going to be in an inflation of commodities like we are now. My worry is now that we're here and I'm starting to say, this smells like late stages of it, And unfortunately, this one isn't focused like 1980, when most commodities more or less peaked from 79 to early to the year of 1980. This one is distributed. It's rotating. We've got the cocoa that topped in 02.
Yeah. The money's moving from place to place.
That's right. And so this whole era will take its time to peak with a spread out top as an era. And you know, the
is that because the interest rates aren't there?
What's that?
Is that because we don't have the high interest rates?
I don't know why, except for the fact that this one is a truly speculative expansion, in my view.
It's wherever the herd's moving.
That's right. And the speculative the end of the 1970s was the hyper speculation. But the first part of it was not hyper speculation. It was a dollar being allowed to float and trying to find its value. And in doing that, because it was being devalued severely, and in doing that, we unleashed all this equity people had saved up. Now, we don't have half the economy. The median income in this country hangs around $35,000.
That's correct.
The bottom half is in trouble.
Everybody under that, you mean?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know why. For instance, here in Champaign County, and I serve on a United Way committee, I think this is right. If you have a family of four, in order to live and not to use some kind of program to aid you in some form, it's either $34,000 or $38,000 that you have to make to live in Urbana-Champaign, roughly speaking.
Family income.
A family income. And you have to be making that much money, or you're going to go to your Eastern Illinois Central Food Bank, Illinois Food Bank, or you're going to do something to subsidize your income because you can't afford to pay for everything. And that's a good salary.
Yeah. That's pretty decent, yeah.
Yeah, and then look at your trends of what's going on, and it's not making much for the news headlines, but we're starting to see we're getting to the highest delinquencies in so many years in certain things, like rental delinquencies, non-secured debt.
When we look at, I want to interrupt here.
Yeah.
When we look at this $34,000 to $38,000, I think the problem is it's both people working making $35,000 between them.
That's correct.
Amen.
And that's the problem.
That is the problem.
I mean, if one person was making $35,000 and one was staying home, I think you'd be in a little better shape. But when they were both working and only making $34,000 between them, that's where the majority. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've got tons of people on that goat.
And if they have young kids, a lot of the reason that they're having to do that, I mean, a lot of the reason that the problem comes in is that they're having to pay for daycare, and it's cost them $100 a week a kid.
Or $200.
Or $200, something like that. It's expensive.
And what happens when one of them was working at Ford where they're laying off, or what? Or whatever else. Or both.
Well, I think it all goes back, Glenn, just to like...
Or one gets sick and they have no health insurance.
What was just said...
They probably don't have health insurance anyway. That's probably where the subsidy's coming in.
Right. Yeah. And what all this means, I think, as I sit back and kind of listen to it, is simply that, we've all gotten to a point where we're... I don't want to say luxurious, but almost luxurious in the fact that we can kind of sort of demand that our service or our good be worth a little more than maybe what it really is because people have had extra money to spend on it.
Amen.
Whereas maybe now we're ending the time, that we had that we don't necessarily have that extra money anymore.
If we were all willing to settle for the standard of living that our grandparents had, most of us would be net savers by a long way.
Oh, 100 times.
And I see us a two-person society. We've got them over there that have nothing, and then a few at the top that have it all.
One other thing that's going on out here in the world right now, and it's one of the reasons why we've got all this speculative money chasing around. I've been hearing what my secretary's husband is tied, not directly, but has been part of a company that has been receiving venture capital, and the venture capital rates that they want for return are going down, down, down. There is far more money available to build businesses, for example, than there is demand to support those businesses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That scares me.
Well, that goes back to last week. We had this discussion with Zwicker on the air, actually, as opposed to in an after the bell segment, which is what we call this one, about the number of dollars that the Fed simply had to put into the marketplace to keep the economy rolling. Sure. And so there are just a lot of dollars around, apparently. And I don't know how many dollars they bumped in or how much greater it is than normal, but apparently there must be a lot of them around.
The problem is with that, though, and that's why we're getting this skewed, is the dollars went into the industries that were supported, et cetera, by the war issues, et cetera, and terrorism issues, and in part at least. And this time around, putting that money out there has not helped the average homeowner, average wage earner, because it isn't getting to him.
Yeah, so it's not it's not manufactured goods,
right?
In wartime sorts of things. So we're not making lots of planes and lots of bombs and those kinds of things that require a lot of manpower.
A great contrast was in the 1920s and 30s. About 77% of the earners in this country were either directly or one level away, employed by, et cetera, or service commodity industries. Today, it's estimated it's about 7%. In other words, the vast majority of the income of back then was variable income based upon things going up and down in the commodity world.
Yep.
Now, the vast majority of the income is quote-unquote fixed.
Service-oriented, yeah.
But when the costs go up, the discretionary money starts going away.
Yeah.
And such, so...
you've said it over and over. Commodity or the cost has gone up. So whether it be gold or it be gasoline, it's all gone up.
The one thing that's hard for me to communicate and also know to my readers well is saying, take the grains for example right now. If the markets keep going up and the money keeps stampeding in, the path of least resistance is up on corn and wheat. If it keeps going, it keeps going. What I'm saying is I see an accident coming. But I also have to be willing to say it's bullish until we reach the cliff, until the accident actually happens.
Yeah.
And so in some ways, with this rotation going on and being so huge, I have to be careful and allow the bullishness to run its course. And I actually believed a year early that the energies were starting to top, and we got breaks, but we didn't get tops.
Mm-hmm.
This time around, when we got the tops in early September, we topped by my work. It ran a year longer. Gold ran almost a year longer and a lot higher. So now I'm really adapting and recognizing that when we do that bubble phase, I just got to stay. I don't want to get in front of it.
Well, can you tell, because you've looked at the markets, can you follow the cash? Do you know who it is that sort of picks the winner and that's where the herd goes?
No.
You can't tell.
I don't focus on that.
I was going to say, I don't know that you could follow it anyway, just because it's kind of like following a herd of people, right? Which one's the leader? Well,
actually, the herd of bison is more accurate because there are no leaders.
Right. It just wherever they go, right?
Right. Yeah. I use technical patterns. I recognize how they're still working pretty well. And the indicator that tells you where the money's going is price.
Mm-hmm.
When you cross key barriers, you make higher highs, higher lows, the money's coming in on net. Or, the path of least resistance, what I'm looking at. I look at corn right now. I've got a chart in front of me of a monthly chart of March corn. And I think about all the major rallies I've ever seen. They're big three-count rallies at minimum. In 1993, March corn bottomed in early 93. The nearby contract in December bottomed in 92. But we ran up into 94, fell back into late 94, and then had the third wave up into 96. Mm. In 02, we had a cycle low in corn. We ran up into late 02, broke back into the mid 03, and then had a big run up into 04. We had a low in early 05. We had a run up into last summer. We retested that low. I think we're starting that third swing up, which is usually the big dynamic one. Fits the drought cycle. And my total fear is if we had the low in 05 and we get the high in 06, 18 months or so out, in comparison, the 5.5-year cycle in 1982 in corn, October of 82, we were topped by August, September of 83. And then the balance of the 5.5-year cycle took you down into 87. I'm worried about being up into 86 or 06, and God forbid that we're down into 2010.
Oh, that's what long-term big bubbles, like you said, do.
Yep.
You oversupply because of an excess price.
Short crop.
Long tail. Yeah, long tail and all that. So
I think anybody out there that follows this stuff, if they want to look at chart patterns and see what is a general model, not a specific model for what might be going on, is to look at cocoa. I happened to spot that way back when we turned up in 2000 and we finally peaked in 02. And they should look at what followed that bull phase.
Mm-hmm.
And so the one thing I will be watching for this year is if March corn or the summer contracts of corn get up close to last summer's highs,
70,
but just
70,
die 70. There. If we turn this thing as a big sideways pattern rather than an uptrend,
you're saying that if we see March corn or July corn trade into the 250s or something like that, like we did last year.
Yeah, I'm getting ready to pull up a July contract.
It had to be 250s or 260s because we never did go to an inverse, I know. And the Dease corn was 73, I think, or 72 for a high.
69.
Yep. 73, I think.
Oh, diesel 5 corn.
Yeah, diesel 5 at that point was.
Anyway, the point, yes. What I'm really looking at is there's two choices here for me as a technician from a probability standpoint, what's coming on the corn market. Either we have a big third wave up that looks like 1983, 1988, 1996, or something like that, or we're working on the big sideways swings and that the highs we made last summer is going to be the top of the range.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the July corn on a July continuation chart, which is probably this year's July, has a high at 78. If we get up into that 78 area, maybe just a touch over it, and then die, that's worrisome to me.
Yeah, but when you say sideways, are we talking a higher plateau sideways or dropping back down?
Sideways from 280 to $2.
Yeah, probably like a tail kind of deal, right? I mean,
yeah. Again. Well, let's say for example, take the argument on July corn that what if 04's high would be akin to the high that cocoa had in 2002. Any of you guys that ever look at cocoa would know or would learn if you when you look at it, you would see that we had a high in 02. Tried to rally out about a year ago when they had record long open interest as we broke out above trading ranges, and then we died. And for now we're into our second full year of a big sideways pattern.
You know, realistically too, though, I mean, you look at the open interest in the spec position on the long side last year, in the mid going into the summer, and beans was the same way. But if I remember right, the record long on corn, which was last summer, if I remember correctly, was like 175 or 90,000, wasn't it? Contracts.
I believe so.
I mean, we're halfway there as of this morning.
Well, just keep in mind, though, too, we changed the rules last summer, last June, and so we've had a year to get used to having bigger spec positions.
Yeah,
that's correct.
Yeah. Yeah, and I understand that, but at the same time, I'm just trying to say that, you know, we set a record. If you're comparing it to cocoa, we had, you know, big time numbers last year, and so perhaps the only thing that changes it is if we have some sort of dry weather cycle this year, and that either propels it higher or pushes it lower.
Right.
Sideways to lower.
I would suggest people think about this in terms of fund activity. Those funds that become always in, the marketplace will eventually adapt to that open interest.
Yeah,
that
I was
going to
say that eventually that'll be like not even there,
right?
In my opinion,
except like you were very right to say, or whoever said it, except when they decide to quit it.
Yeah, yeah.
When we really get in trouble. Then we die by the sword.
Yeah.
You mean when they decide to quit it and get out altogether,
right.
not
when those
to
people
roll,
that are always in decide to get out, then
when the herd, to use your analogy, goes somewhere else.
And one thing too about those funds out there, the one thing people should also realize that when it is a fund activity, it's almost never a single investor.
Right.
And what if some of the investors start pulling out of those funds? Then their amount of money when they do a roll
doesn't go with it.
It won't be as big.
Yeah.
So those kind of things, and that would actually be the kindest way to have that bleed away. Now, that may take a decade. It may take 2 decades. It may take a year. I don't know.
Yeah.
But that historically, these ebbs and flows is rotating from entity to entity. I mean, we topped the commodities in this from 74 to 80, and then part of that money goes over and helps fuel the stock market growth.
Right. Right, which is going to be necessary here again sometime. You know, Glenn, I have to ask one question real quick, and then I'm sure we probably got to let you go, and we all got to get going. But,
sure. But
you know, coming from an old farm boy here that, you know, kind of grew up in the farming or on a farm and then also went to the elevator industry and, you know, saw how Cargill does business and ran an elevator and yada, yada. You know, I can say and I can definitely make a case for being short and rolling forward in a carry market. But it's awful tough for a guy to understand how can you be long and roll forward in a carry market. Because, you know, if I want to own something now, I don't necessarily want to own the nearby, do I?
Are you old enough to remember 1980?
I was two in 1980.
Okay, well, let me put it to you this way. A lot of us that were farming back then, we used to look at the neighbors and said, we don't understand how they do it. We were attending their auctions in the mid-'80s.
Yeah.
Because it didn't work in the long run. And I agree with you 100%. This roll thing, I haven't figured out how they're going to make it work forever.
I mean, it's one thing if you buy, let's say you bought Dease corn at $2, right?
Yep.
Then you rolled to March when it went off at, let's say, a 14-cent carry or something like that, because normally they push it to the end, right?
Sure.
Okay, so now you got a 10-cent gain. If you just take from where they rolled to right now, that's a 10-cent gain, right?
In
about, what, 2 months or a month, I should say? Or, yep. Well, no, 2 months, because you had to roll before the Dease went off. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not bad money, but it's not great money.
Now, in terms of the Cargill mentality, merchandising type mentality, yeah. I agree with you 100%. And what happens is, you know, out there, these guys keep getting bled by doing this kind of a roll long term, yeah. unless they score the big one someplace.
Yeah, which is the $3.50 or the $5 corn.
So it's the same difference, more or less, of continuing to buy. Whatever you can buy for out of the money call options in the grains this time of year, buying them for summer markets and hitting a drought every now and then.
Right. Which so. You have to get lucky to do that. But so one thing real quick on cocoa. I don't know the cocoa market very well at all. In general, is there, you know, when I think of markets, I think corn, soybeans, wheat, carries, and spreads, and what kind of merchandising ability I have and all that stuff. Is there a similar setup in the cocoa market, or is it much more of a cash-oriented market?
I don't know.
Okay. I wonder, you know, do you have a May, July, and December cocoa where you've got carry?
It's structured contract-wise very similar to the grains.
Yeah, and so you do have carries and spreads? And
well, yeah, right now, for example, March is 1474, May is 15. July 1523 out to Sep 1542, next Dease 1570.
Mm.
So, I mean, when you give me those numbers, I generally would just say, well, there must be a little bit of an excess of cocoa then because somebody's paying somebody to carry it.
Well, it's not in a general uptrend. It's actually in a general sideways trend. No, I agree with you 100% on that kind of a thing. Absolutely.
I mean, eventually fundamentals win out. That's what I guess I keep preaching. And I mean, that doesn't mean I can't be wrong, but eventually that if you live by the fundamentals, you'll die by the fundamentals, I guess. Or
the challenge with fundamentals is, I agree with you on that, and I'm not a fundamental trader but at all, but I still agree with it in the sense that the problem with it is timing. When can you get the market to respond to them, and when has the market accounted for them? Which I think is a great example this winter.
I agree.
When we got the bearish grain reports in January, and we quit going down.
Yeah.
Yep.
That was the icing on the cake. By the corn bottom and wheat bottom to the week of a 34-week cycle, I was tracking. The guy that reads the newsletter, I held my nose to buy wheat and beans, for example, when I have.
Yeah.
But so far, so good, on especially on the wheat side.
Yeah. And you said earlier that looks like Kansas City probably ran its course. I had heard another analyst say the same thing. The 415 area on July, or on July wheat, I think it was, or Kansas City wheat, I should say, is kind of the topside objective they were talking about.
Wait a minute. Short-term.
Short-term. Yeah.
Because short-term if March Kansas City were to come back and set on top of the 395 area again, especially if it took a week or two to get it done, a gentle breakdown on that type area, I'd be back buying wheat again.
Okay.
Using that as a benchmark right now. Because if you look at a long-term March Kansas City wheat pattern, I mean, we had a beautiful breakout of a trading range going on.
Yeah.
But I think on a short-term basis, we're in the risk of running our course for the time being.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. I don't know. I kind of got the hair up my butt to own corn and sell wheat today, I guess. And so, we back out to, what, $1.36 or something like that between the two, the Julys, I should say.
Yeah.
So.
Well,
having
been a producer of winter wheat out in South Dakota, I'm scared to death the way this winter has gone down in the southern plains because it's been too warm.
Yep.
You know, you lose if you're too warm and then we turn cold, or if we're too warm for the winter, you dehydrate the upper layers.
Yep.
And we're so vulnerable to then the changing weather patterns as we go into spring.
Right.
I'm really worried about what's going to happen in that wheat crop.
I have to pass one other thing along too. My uncle and my dad were having lunch here a couple weeks ago, and my uncle mentioned that he had listened to KMOX, a radio station, AM station out of St. Louis.
Yep, and, I know it.
And said he said that they were discussing the rainfall patterns in Seattle this year. It had rained for 30-some straight days, or just about 30-some straight days. And they mentioned that the last time that that happened was 53 and 54, somewhere back in there. And I remember distinctly my grandpa discussing his 7 bushel per acre corn back in 53 or 54. So, I mean, as far as weather's concerned, I don't necessarily like the way some of this stuff's setting up either. But at the same time, I mean, I got to be honest with you, a lot of my guys are short 60% of their new crop corn, too. So.
Yeah. I don't have any problem, by the way. The marketing strategies, all that matters to me is that they create a plan and they follow it.
Yeah.
And even if part of that plan is to, when things go that they don't understand, is to get out of the way, that's fine with me, too.
Yeah.
I've got a lot of my guys, I said, if you sell this stuff and we break out above 52, 53 in the corn, you've got to be prepared to offset it someplace. I've made a point to the guys I work with the marketing clubs in that it doesn't necessarily have to be done right away.
Right.
But when we come back to retest that, which is probably a 90% probability that whatever rally we have in D's corn will come back and sit on top of this area, that's when I want to take a look at it.
Sure.
Glenn, we need to go.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Thanks very much, Glenn. I apologize. Hopefully Todd's not mad at us here.
And
no,
again, if
I'm
the
not.
Other guys want any of those back issues, have them email me if need be.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Glenn.
Thanks, guys.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.